In the far right-hand corner of the lobby was a towering Christmas tree, and from a balcony above them, Silent Night, being played on a piano, drifted down. We're talking to Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys' super mystery, A Crime for Christmas. Hit it! It was 1988. The California Raisins released their Christmas album. The Ford Escort was the most popular vehicle. Geraldo interviewed Charles Manson, and Frank and Joe Hardy teamed up with Nancy Drew to stop cat burglars, kidnappers, and terrorists. I'm your host, Jerry D, with another episode of Totally Rad Christmas, the podcast that talks all things Christmas in the 80s. Toys, movies, specials, music, and fads. If it was gnarly during Christmas in the 80s, we got it covered. Now, before I introduce my guest, it's time for the 80s word of the day. As always, this comes from the Dictionary of 1980s Slang by Rick Carlisle. Today's word is trendoid, noun, one who robotically follows fashion, a mixture of trendy and android. For example, a trust fund trendoid named Guy from New York Magazine, May 1986. Use it all the time. joining me is a totally rad Christmas all-star. From a cozy Christmas podcast, it's three-time Ratty winner, Art Kilmer. Art, what's happening?
Hey, how are you? Things are well on my end.
Okay, good. They're pretty good here too, yeah. overall, I've had to be a super dad lately because my wife actually broke her ankle.
Oh, no. So
pulling double duty, and I'm tired.
Yeah, you realize how much your wife helps you when they're down for the count. So,
oh, I know.
My wife had foot surgery last year, and so she had to stay off of it for 6 weeks.
Yeah, I definitely say she does. Maybe now looking on things, like, realistically, she does about 90%. I could have sworn it was more like maybe 55, 45, or maybe 60, 40, but nope. She definitely does so much, and I'm very grateful. So
so you should be having a good Father's Day then, is what you're saying.
I hope so.
I'm earning points here.
We'll see. Come on. Speaking of fathers, Fenton Hardy.
Yeah.
So we're talking about the Hardy Boys today. What's your experience with the Hardy Boys, or what fondness do you have for the Hardy Boys?
Well, I first of all really want to just thank you for reaching out to me, because the Hardy Boys were a foundational moment in my childhood.
Nice.
I am a big reader. If anyone's listened to my podcast, they know how much I love books. Yeah. No secrets there. And my love for reading really took off when one day my grandma handed me a Hardy Boys book that she picked up from a yard sale, and said, well, I saw these. I thought maybe you'd like them, you know, because by that point they'd been around for ages, and probably my dad read them. And so she saw them and got them for me. And if I think about it, I can even remember the book title and everything. I can see the picture of the cover. I think it was called Tic-Tac Terror or TikTok Terror, something like that. And but I'm reading this, so it's like kids solving mysteries, and they're cool teenagers, and like all this freedom and stuff they do and solve mystery and fight crime. And it was like a match on gasoline. And I just tore through all the series. I read the Case Files when I was a teenager. They had a Hardy Boy Case Files. And honestly, even until probably 18 to 20 years old, I was still reading them off and on a little bit. I grew out of them, but I just had other things to read, and life happens and all that. But I was able to introduce them to my kids. I don't know if they caught on with them just as much as I did, but they enjoyed it. My boys did anyway. And but yeah, this so I credit the Hardy Boys for just being that spark that got me into reading and realized how fun reading could be. And it's something that I have I still wholly embrace. It's just the joy of reading. So I am indebted to the Hardy Boys for that.
And that's super awesome. It's actually very similar to my own story. So when I knew I wanted to cover the Hardy Boys, I did a little bit of research, discovered, yes, there was this particular Christmas one. I think there's actually like one or two more from the Case Files that maybe we'll cover those later on. But this is the one that I found first. And all of a sudden, the very first person I thought of when I saw the cover was you, because of your books, you know, in your book series. I mean, So I thought, you know what, I'm sure he's into it. Let me ask. And sure enough, you're like, yes, let's do it. So thank you for saying yes. But yeah, my story is very similar. So I think I was in first grade. I was having trouble falling asleep. And my dad actually handed me an old Hardy Boys book that was his. So it was from the 50s, and it was before they actually started, you know, because in 59 they started adjusting them and rewriting and, you know, stuff like that, making them a little more tolerable, I suppose. a little PC is probably what you'd say nowadays, but, you know, just making them a little bit better. Although a lot of people didn't like that. They thought that it kind of really dumbed down the series. But anyway, so this was like one of the original ones, and it was The Melted Coins. I remember that one. That was the very first one I read. My dad was like, yeah, I used to love these growing up. Maybe you'd like them. And so I read it and I was hooked, just like you. So I was like, well, this is number, I think it was like 14 or something. It's like, I got to go back and start at number one. And so I just worked my way down and till I got, I think till about 40 something. And then I kind of same, just like you, started reading other things. And then when the Case Files came out, I started reading those, and I'll never forget the one that I loved, 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 because, you know, I'm a superhero comic book guy. So there was this one called The Last Laugh, and it was like an intersection of those two loves, where they're like at a convention and some legit supervillains show up and they're like, what's going on? Like, this guy's like throwing flame from his hands and this guy's lifting up cars. And of course it's all, you know, high tech gimmicks and whatever. But you know, I was like, yes, this is awesome, and I loved it. And so whenever, you know, a show would come out or anything Hardy Boys, I'd try my best to get into it. I was never quite into Nancy Drew, you know, like I was the Hardy Boys. I think maybe I read one Nancy Drew book before this.
Yeah, I haven't read any. My sister liked Nancy Drew. And I think my wife, my wife has read them. Actually, we have a box of really old Nancy Drew books that are just kind of in the closet right now. So nice. Maybe Grace will will latch onto them someday. So
you never know. Yep. Same thing. My wife liked Nancy Drew. I don't know. I guess just the Hardy Boys were more action, a little bit more action adventure. Plus, you know, their detective skills, and so they just appealed to me more. So, but this is part of what's called the Super Mysteries series. And it actually kind of piggybacks on the continuity built in that 1987 Case Files series. So there's almost like a multiverse of everything's multiverse these days. There's like a multiverse of Hardy Boys. So there's the original series. The Case Files came out, and that's when, like in the very first one, I think Chet Morton's sister gets car bombed.
Well, it's I know it's it was Joe's girlfriend. I don't
right, Iola.
I don't know. Yeah, if, yeah, I don't know if she was his sister or not. Actually, I don't remember that. Yeah. Hmm. Okay.
Yeah, it was Iola Morton. So it's Chet's little sister. She's the one that would date Joe. She gets like blown up. Right. So you know, it's just like, whoa, okay, this is like serious now.
I was hooked from the first chapter. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so this particular series that we're going to be talking about, this book actually piggybacks off that one. It's in that continuity. There's also another series that started, I think, in 2005 or so. And that one still has Iola living. Like so that's kind of closer to the original series.
Sure.
But the premise of the book, and we'll, I'll get into the history in a little bit, but essentially the premise is these two, you know, teenage boys, Frank and Joe Hardy, who originally were 15 and 16, but after the revisions in the 50s were aged up to 18 and 17. And so Frank and Joe are brothers. They're sons of a very famous detective, Fenton Hardy, and they essentially solve crimes. And they solve crimes that even the police can't.
Yeah.
Although go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, it's just so fun. Imagining teenagers running around, getting the liberties they got to do and have,
oh, yeah.
Just solving crime and going where they wanted. And yeah.
Oh, it's a lot of that stuff nowadays. I don't think it'd fly so much.
Right. Right.
But yeah. Yeah.
I was reading this book as a parent, you know, and I'm like, wait, two teenagers are meeting girl teenagers in a hotel in New York City without any kind of parent supervision here?
Yes.
Hold on.
And it did make me wonder, because they are young, but are they still like 17 and 18 in this series? Because they don't actually specify. Mm. But I always wondered if in the case files they were a little bit older. You know, I wasn't quite sure if maybe they were like in their early 20s.
I thought they were still teenagers.
I mean, they might be. I don't recall.
Yeah, that was my, they're kind of forever stuck at 17 and 18, I think.
Yeah. 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 I understand.
It's been a while. It's been a while. My memory's been kind of foggy. So.
Well, so their very first novel, The Hardy Boys, was published in 1927. The idea was created by Edward Stratemeyer, who actually had like a book, I don't know, distribution firm, book packaging kind of firm, I guess, called Stratemeyer Syndicate, which is funny because later on, anytime you start doing research on the ghostwriters involved in all these and the authors, it's always like, well, and the syndicate wouldn't allow them to do this. And the syndicate, and it almost sounds like a crime, like a crime family or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Organized crime, you know, oh, the syndicate. But essentially he came up with this idea and he tried to sell it and he sold it, but you know, they didn't like the name. He was thinking of like the Keen Boys and other, he had other names, and eventually the publishers themselves decided on Hardy Boys, which I thought was kind of interesting. But it makes sense. I mean, they are kind of hardy if you think about it. So it actually has like a little play there.
It really taps into that, I don't know, all American boy kind of persona, you know, that, I don't know, they're ready for anything at any moment.
Pretty much. Yeah. 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 You know, Boy Scout, football player, you know, that kind of, yeah, definitely taps into that, which as a young boy reading these, I was just enthralled.
Yeah, when your arms are about as big as a, you know, a stick, and you're not very sporty, you get some idols. Yeah.
So Edward created these characters and he would write the outline, he and his daughter, and depending on what year it was, either his daughter Amanda or his other daughter. Anyway, so like they would plot it out, they would create the outline, and then they'd send it to their ghostwriters. And their ghostwriters would actually, you know, write the whole story and then publish it under the name Franklin W. Dixon. So I remember always thinking Franklin W. Dixon was just, you know, one guy growing up. Mm-hmm. So in the 80s, when he had something and knowing that his first one was published in like 1920 something, I was like, man, this guy's been writing forever. How old is he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is, I remember I was in the library and I saw it was like a biography or something about the original writer of Franklin W. Dixon, whoever that was. I can't remember now. And I was like, wait, what? Franklin W. Dixon is just a pen name?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no. Man. When I found out, yeah, it like broke my heart.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The most famous ghostwriter, he wrote actually 17 out of the very first 25 books. Is Leslie McFarlane. He was a Canadian and he actually didn't like writing it, but they paid pretty well. They paid $125 per book, which of course back then was quite a lot of money. Mm-hmm. During the Depression, they actually lowered it to, I think, like $75, but he had done so many and his were sold so well that they actually would advance him and actually gave him more. They gave him like $85 or something. So, but yeah, I mean, like all their ghostwriters, they had to sign away any rights to any ownership of the stories and manuscripts. I mean, it was all very, you know, they couldn't use the Franklin W. Dixon name anywhere else. It had to be only with this specific book series. And so I just, it's really interesting that, you know, this whole process of getting all these different writers. Now, he wrote up to like 20 something. He kind of left for a bit, then he came back and did like a few more. I think his wife even actually wrote a couple, but then it was John Button that took over after he kind of backed away from it. Mm-hmm. So those are like the two main ones. And then of course we have a bunch of other ones that, that started writing others. Now with the Nancy Drew side, I believe it was actually the Carolyn Keene was the pen name used for the Nancy Drew series, which is the book that we're talking about, is part of the Super Mysteries series. So this debuted in 1988. This is the second book in that mm-hmm. series. It's based mostly off of Nancy Drew's kind of point of view. Most of the books in this particular series, which I didn't realize because I, as much as I love the Hardy Boys, this was actually one that I missed. I never actually read this one growing up, which is strange because I read like almost all of them. So it was very fun diving back into this world. And
it really was. Yeah.
Some of their exploits are a little ridiculous, but man, I loved it. Like I loved every single moment of it. Oh
yeah. Yeah. It's you got to go in expecting ridiculousness and you're, I don't know. It's just fun. It was nostalgic. You know, again, it if I can get the parent side of my head to be quiet, you know, these young kids teenagers running around New York City. And, you know, even just the ridiculousness of the plot, you know, the mayor of New York City, hiring them to help him uncover, you know, this burglary ring and all that. Like, okay, sure. As one does, you hire teenagers. Sure.
You hire some teenagers, man.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean,
oh well.
Maybe you'd look at like 21 Jump Street. And,
sure. Yeah. There you go.
I guess I don't know. It's definitely out there. It doesn't quite make sense, but it actually did kind of feel very Hardy Boys. Mm-hmm. A lot of their adventures, and I think out of all the ones I read, I still really love the first one, The Tower Treasure.
Doubloons and pieces of eight handed down to Applegate from buccaneers who fought for years for gold doubloons and pieces of eight handed down in a pirate's chest, the gold they sailed for east and west, the treasure bright that made men fight till none were left to bury the chest. So now the gold and pieces of eight all belong to Applegate. The chest is here, but wait, now, where are those gold doubloons and pieces of eight, pieces of eight, pieces of eight?
Today's episode in the mystery of the Applegate treasure, The Tower Treasure.
I don't know, something about it, just it's like the beginning of that world. And so it drew me in, but it felt like it, like this one felt like it could have just slid in with some of the others, you know, that dealt with smuggling and, you know, lost fortunes and things like that. So it was kind of like a warm blanket in a lot of ways, like just reading it. And it was a super quick read, you know, mm-hmm. I thought it was going to take me long. And I think I finished it in like a couple hours. Just so fast. It's only like 215 pages or so.
But. I know I've read some in the series, and actually the cover looked pretty familiar to me. So I wouldn't be surprised if I had read it when I was a kid, but I loved whenever there was a crossover like that. You know, it's like early Avengers, you know, for me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I wasn't really into comic books, so that was my Avengers, you know.
That's a good one to have.
Yeah, yeah.
It reminded me of in 1977, I think, they actually had a TV show. I don't know if you remember. And it was like the mm-hmm. Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys Hour or something like that. So it would be like they'd have one episode on the Hardy Boys, one episode on Nancy Drew. Now, that was like the first season. The second season, they focused more on the Hardy Boys, but they still had a couple of Nancy Drew episodes in there. And one of them actually is a Christmas episode. So I'm excited to dive into that later on, too.
Yeah. I've never watched the show, but I know what you're talking about. Yeah. I think my mom watched it quite a bit.
Nice.
She was a big fan of it. Yeah.
That's awesome. Did you have before we dive into the book, did you actually have a favorite book?
Not that I can think of. I mean, I have a fondness for the first one I ever read. And like I said, I really liked the Case Files in the mm-hmm. first. I always think of the first one as just being like, wow, you know, that I thought they were good before, but it was something about, you know, killing off Iola, poor thing, that
I know,
I'm like, wow, this is real. Like, they just made this real somehow to my, I don't know how old I was, like 13 or 14. But I loved that they ramped up the action. The stakes seemed higher in a lot of them. And it really just caught my attention, you know, where I was at, just like the books did when I was younger. And I just love how that hit me. I mean, that whole series hit me at least twice at the right age. And really just continued to inspire me to read. I would say at least the first book in the Case Files, I have a fondness for, just because it was like, I don't know, this is big and dramatic, and I love it.
Well, and they actually work for like a government agency, I think. They help out and they have like a contact named like the Gray Man or something like that. It's been a while since I've read them all, but you know, he's kind of like their guy. And I think they were called the Network. I think that was the name of the agency. They would go up against like a group of assassins. I mean, it was like, you know, it was big time stuff, which, you know, for a couple of teenage kids is crazy.
I was going to say, I loved it all. It was great and over the top, and I didn't care. I was there for it. So
same here. Yeah.
Yeah.
Same here. So Frank, and it's kind of, some critics of the original series, especially after the revisions, but some critics said that the only difference between Frank and Joe is that Frank had dark hair and Joe was blonde.
Yeah.
And now as the Case Files started progressing, and even throughout the original series, but we started to get more differences. We can actually see those differences in this particular book here, where mm-hmm. Frank is more of like the, let's think about this before we dive in. And Joe is definitely much more the, I'm all action. Let's dive in right now. Mm-hmm. Which both of them are still very smart, both still can do a lot of things. But like in the Case Files, Frank is a little more into like bombs and like diffusing bombs, especially after Iola's death. He really like, you know, started learning about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I think there was one where he like disarmed a nuclear bomb.
I was just thinking that. Yeah. Yeah.
It's very MacGyver.
One of the books, there is this little poem he recited to himself, like about which wires to cut. And it said something like red before yellow and you're a good fellow, but yellow before red and then you're dead. Something like that. You know? And I still remember that. Whenever I see a bomb cutting or a bomb diffusing scene in a movie or TV show, I always think back to that part. Cut them in the right order.
And Joe was definitely made to be much more athletic in that one. Mm-hmm. The cool thing I always liked about the Hardy Boys is that they always really got along with each other. They never really fought, you know, maybe every once in a while there was a squabble, but most of the time they were just great brothers. And so, you know, we mm-hmm. tried our best, my brothers and I, to kind of be like that. And I think that's awesome, because your brother or sister, really your sibling, is like your first best friend, really. Mm-hmm. So it's just, yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. But yeah, I had a, my brother, he's a couple years older than me. And when I, especially when we were younger, I had really blonde hair. He had dark hair. So I always told him, I said, I was imagine him and I as Frank and Joe. And nice. You know, I always was Joe. He was Frank. And, you know, we'd sometimes play like that, or, you know, play Star Wars, or, you know, all the games we played. And yeah, we played Hardy Boys too occasionally. So we were trying to put together our little detective kits and everything. I think
that's cool.
I think all we ended up having was a magnifying glass and a notebook, but we were ready. So,
hey, that's all you need, really. Yep, I mean, look at Hercule Poirot, you know, a little gray cells and that's it.
Gray cells. Yeah.
But yeah, in this one, it's implied that Nancy Drew and Frank Hardy kind of, there's like an attraction there, a mutual attraction. Mm-hmm. Never really played out because Frank, and this is continued from the original series, but Frank has his girlfriend, Kelly Shaw. Mm-hmm. Nancy Drew is with her boyfriend, Ned. So she kind of feels guilty, and we get like that little bit of sense of, you know, why did I say Frank's name, or why did I think of Frank, you know, you know, that kind of thing. Which is fun. You know, it's very high school.
yeah. I gotta admit, I really hope that Frank and Nancy Drew would get together someday.
Me too.
Sorry for all those, you know, who like the other couples, but like those two, man, they've got to have ended up together.
I agree. You know,
okay, good.
No, I ship them too. Yep.
Like, come on, their babies will be smart, like super smart.
Oh, I know. Yeah, imagine the detective skills they're gonna have.
yeah.
So yes, the mayor of New York. Apparently, there's these cat burglars that have been terrorizing establishments throughout New York, stealing high profile targets. So in this case, it's a crown jewels of a country. I'm going to pronounce it Sarcon, but I'm not sure exactly. Sarcon, I don't know. It's like a quasi-French country. And mm-hmm. I looked it up. Of course, there really is no real country like this. And the only other word very similar is Italian. So as far as pronunciation goes, I'm just going to say Sarcon, I guess.
Works for me. Yeah. I wouldn't even know where to begin to pronounce it. So,
so it's a fictionalized country. They're going to be joining the UN officially. They've had like a sort of informal agreement as like a part of it, but they're going to be joining officially. And in honor of that, and in honor of their like 500th year, I guess, as a country, they're touring the States, showing off their crown jewels, and like the prince of that country is there. So that's like one plot line going on. And because of this big event, the mayor with these cat burglars on the loose is worried that, you know, something's going to happen. So all they know, and all police and FBI and anybody has ever really gotten to know, is that one of the cat burglars is older and the other one is younger, kind of maybe even a teenager or early 20s. So it's because of this, and I guess because of their work in the network, or maybe just because their dad is Fenton Hardy, but the Hardy Boys are and Nancy Drew are commissioned, I guess is the right word, are commissioned to investigate and hopefully catch the cat burglars. That's kind of like where we start off.
Yeah. And all I can think of is, I think, is it Iron Man when he says it's not a bad plan. I can't remember what movie that was in now, but it's like, okay, that kind of makes sense. I mean, it's not a bad plan, I suppose.
Well, I know he tells Loki, not a great plan.
Not a great plan. That's what it is. Okay, yeah, not a great plan. Got the quote right. There you go.
But it's okay. It's an okay plan, I guess. They're hoping that maybe they can connect with the younger member of the cat burglar duo and maybe kind of infiltrate that way and sniff them out. And that's like, I mean, at this point they're grasping at straws because they, like, police have nothing, the federal agencies have nothing. So it's like, why not? Let's go for this. Maybe these young folks will attract young cat burglars' attention, make friends with them or something. So, you know, it's kind of like Fast and the Furious, I guess.
I guess so.
Or actually, I guess it really is like 21 Jump Street. You know, the young looking detectives are put in high school and stuff.
Right. Yeah, that's a show I haven't watched yet or at all. So.
Oh, I got you. Yeah.
That had Johnny Depp in it, though, right?
He did.
Okay. Yeah, that's the one. Okay. Man. Yeah, that was, I don't know. I wasn't quite old enough for it, I think, when it was out. And it was too old. So.
Yeah, same here. I wasn't really into it. I watched a few episodes and then I did the Christmas episode on it. So I kind of know a little bit more about it, but it really kind of, I was just, I think, a little out of their demographic at the time it debuted, but it's kind of the same premise. So they're staying at this fancy hotel and it's all comped because they're helping them out because they think the police and the hotel management think that they're using their hotel as like a rallying point, like a headquarters or jumping off a hub, I guess, or base after they commit their crimes. And so they put them up in this hotel, they give them the different rooms, and they essentially not really doing much. They kind of go their separate ways and go shopping, and while Frank and Joe are doing something else. So this is how we're introduced. We're first introduced to Nancy Drew and her friend Bess Marvin, and they're shopping, and they go to this like bakery, and Bess, who's kind of boy crazy, sees this cute worker there at the bakery, and she sees, like, she's just so hungry, she wants something to eat, and so they want to buy these chocolate crowns that they find, and he's like, well, that's for a special order, I can't do it, but he ends up like sneaking one to her, and that kind of starts this whole ball rolling.
Yeah, I had to laugh at just the first chapter. I told my wife, I said, this first chapter just set feminism back, 30 years. it had all the tropes, of women shopping and being hungry for chocolate and talking about boys. And maybe it's just because I'm a 40-year-old fella now, and it I don't remember what being a kid was like, but like, come on.
Yeah, it's not the most appropriate, but there's things. Yeah, it's definitely of its time. We'll just say that.
Yeah, well, as my wife did point out, she's like, well, it was written about 30 years ago, if you do the math, and thinking, oh no, yeah, that's right. You're right. Yeah.
Oh, so don't say that.
We've come a long way.
Yeah, we have. So she's on her way. They're going to meet Frank and Joe, and someone tries to steal her bag with the chocolate crown in it. Of course, they don't realize that's why. They just, someone stole their bag. It's Christmas time. There's a lot of crime. Mm-hmm. And this is still that era of New York where it's a little bit grimier and a little not quite as nice as it is now. Mm-hmm. Crime was a lot more prevalent. But Frank and Joe actually manage to stop them, and so everything's fine. They go back to the hotel and they go to their different rooms. Now, I think this is where we meet John, right?
I believe so. Isn't he climbing up the outside of the building?
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yes. So they meet this guy named John. And he invites them out. They're like, no. But Bess is immediately taken with him because he's handsome and suave, whatever. And then they go up to their rooms, and John is like climbing up the side of the building. And, he taps on their window because he overheard what room they were in. Yeah. They like let him in. But like, what? Like, this guy's just climbing up the side of a building in New York?
Oh, that's right, because they met him first, and then he climbed up the side of the building to get into their room. Yeah.
To get it? Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Warning bells are going off in my head.
Exactly. Like, come on, guys.
Stalker much?
And they're just, the whole time, they're just like, huh, that's weird.
Come on in. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, no, don't don't do that. Stranger danger.
I know. Did you all learn about stranger danger?
But they let him in. And finally, he's like, no, I just had to see you guys. I just had to see you again, Bess. And let's all go out. So he convinces them, even though they need to get to work. They're like, fine, I guess we can do that. So they go out. And he keeps them out quite late.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to be back by a certain time so that they could actually go over all their notes. But instead, they go to dinner. And I think they also go to a club to dance, I believe.
Yep, doing all the New York things, I guess. And I don't know New York City, but going to a club at midnight, that just sounds dangerous to me, you know.
I think, especially in the 80s.
Yeah, I'm a country guy, I guess. I don't know, this idea of being in the big city just kind of frightens me. I mean, the big city I'm comfortable in is Omaha, you know.
yeah, I hear you.
It's not that
well
big.
And it's also funny because it's Christmas time.
Yeah,
so it's like, well, what was there's all this Christmas imagery, you know, there's the trees, mm-hmm. you know, the decorations, you hear the cab driver mixing up the words to the Christmas song, and so all this is going on. And the atmosphere must be beautiful. I imagine, mm-hmm. you know, everything's just gorgeous there with all the decorations and everything. But eventually they get back to their room and they find out that their room has been ransacked. Nancy Drew's and Bess's room. So, you know, they look, nothing seems to be stolen. Of course, they report it. But one thing that kind of they thought about was earlier, because Joe kind of has like a thing for Bess Marvin. At this point, and it makes sense, at this point his girlfriend is, you know, has passed, so he's kind of a free agent, I guess. And so yeah. He kind of has a little thing for Bess, and you know, she was flirting with John, and
yep, he's trying, I don't know, it felt like, well, here's a single girl and so I'm gonna like her, you know.
Yeah, it did feel a lot like that. Yeah,
although that's pretty much Joe in every book, I think. So
I think you're
in
right.
The case files. Yeah.
So he noticed while they were out that John was talking to like this dude for a long time, you know, this older gentleman. So right away he starts thinking, well, older gentleman, younger guy, the guy's climbing buildings, maybe they're the cat burglar. And I did notice the book almost has like two different parts. Like there's the beginning where they're really focused on this cat burglar, and then like the last half of the book where they're not. And we'll get into why in a little bit. But in this part, like they're still really focused on the cat burglar aspect. Mm-hmm. And so he starts thinking, well, maybe this guy's in on it, especially now that their room has been ransacked. You know, he kept them out way later. Maybe he was doing this so that his partner could come in and ransack the room.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing valuable has been stolen. So they're a little confused as to why anyone broke in. So there's that. Then the next day, Joe is taking pictures in the lobby. Thinks he's being smooth, taking pictures like the architecture. And basically any like older gentleman, younger gentleman together, he takes pictures of and clocks like, hey, maybe this is them. Mm-hmm. So, it's... But he gets discovered by a young British redhead named Fiona.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they kind of have a little playful, flirty banter. And that's kind of the end of that for the moment.
Yeah. And wasn't he like taking pictures of her too from like from the distance or something? And
he was. Yeah. And yeah. He even says he got carried away.
Yeah, Joe. that's not going to work. Yeah.
Yeah. So John shows up again, tries to convince them. He's like, please help me get out of this hotel. You know, I'm getting so antsy. And so they help him sneak out, but they're stopped by police who recognize that John is actually Jean-Claude, the Prince of Sarcone. And of course, Bess is like, whoa, you know, dreamboat now, especially now.
Yeah.
So, you know, he convinces them. His uncle's with him, and he convinces his uncle, Renault, I believe is his name. Mm-hmm. He convinces that these are his friends. You know, they're actually detectives. They're on a case. And, you know, maybe they'll be his bodyguards. And because really he kind of had, you get this feeling that he's really frustrated with his life. Everywhere he goes, people recognize him. He's just, it's all stuffy. He wants to be away from everybody. So that's like his excuse. But while they go out, they go out to I guess they go dancing, and there's an attempt to kidnap him. You know, they have to fight off the guys and they escape. And there's like, this happens quite a few times where he's almost kidnapped.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think some of that was before the Hardy Boys were hired to be his bodyguards or something. But yeah, it's like he's got a big target on his back or something, and he just keeps getting kidnapped, and or somebody gets kidnapped or something. Crime is just running rampant in New York.
Well, yeah, because when they're at the club and someone tries to get, they think, you know, they're after Jean-Claude, but they actually go after Bess, or Joe notices, like, it looks like they're going after Bess first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jean-Claude starts fighting him off, and the Hardys start fighting him off, and because Frank is, you know, Frank, he actually had, like, a guidebook to their, you know, hotel and some of the sites, and he learned about all the different tunnels, and so he's able to... He's kind of able to fight, fend off and cut him off at the pass. You know, it's there's a lot of little funny things like this going around.
Yeah, I just thought, you know, Frank, you're a nerd, but you're a cool nerd, you know?
Yeah. Hey, Nancy's into it, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she is.
Oh, man.
Yep.
So Joe sets up like a mini... film developing studio in the bathroom of their hotel, and so he develops some pictures. As they're out and they go return to their room, their room is also a mess, and of course they're like, well, what's going on? They're obviously looking for something. Maybe it's the burglars are onto us, and you know, but look, here are all the pictures, they're still here, so maybe not, or maybe they're not in these. Later on, and I love this bit, he's with Fiona, and I know I'm skipping around. I should have taken better notes as I was reading. I was just so enthralled.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. I took notes about halfway through, and then I just got caught up in it.
Yeah. Same thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's with Fiona, and they're developing the pictures, and she's like, you know, ooh, do you have a picture of me? I'd like a picture of me. She's like, is this your only copy? He's like, yeah, but I'll make you one. And they hear a noise outside. He goes out and he gets like beamed. And so he's down for the count. When he wakes up, like they go in and Fiona's locked in the closet and all the pictures are gone. The film has been, you know, the negatives have been completely destroyed. And so it's like, okay, well, they definitely know that we're onto him now.
Mm-hmm.
They also find Fiona's dad turns out to be like a doctor, and he checks him out. He's like, yeah, he's okay. It's, you know, no big deal. And so there's that plot point as well.
I had to laugh at that point because I was thinking back over the series and how many times have these two boys been knocked unconscious?
They probably have had so many concussions.
I know. In their lives. This is where being an adult comes in and kind of ruins the story for me, you know. He's probably like 40 years old and can't even function anymore because he's got so much damage to his mind.
No, don't say that. Oh, that's bad.
Oh, yeah.
It's true, though, but it's bad. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, poor. Hopefully they had good health insurance. I don't know.
For real.
Yeah.
But we get several attempts on the prince, several kidnapping attempts on the prince. And so there's one where they're in carriages and, you know, he like tells the boys, no, you go in that carriage. Well, Bess and I will be over here. So Frank and Nancy are like in this other carriage, and a black limo shows up and actually kidnaps them. And Frank and Nancy are like, what's going on? But like, that's not the very first attempt. So there's the one in the club. There's one, another one earlier on. And it's just like, people keep trying to kidnap, you know, Jean-Claude. And so they're not sure, like, why? Is it just because he's a prince? Like, is there a ransom note that's going to come? Like, what is the purpose of these kidnappings? They don't seem to understand what it is at all. And I thought that was kind of an interesting point, you know, that they don't really know what's going on. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, in the books, I mean, I always remembered in the older series, there was a lot of that mystery, but also they kind of always had like a little bit of a clue, like to figure out, well, maybe it's because of this or maybe this, but they're just like, they don't seem to understand like how this fits in with the cat burglars. Are the cat burglars doing the kidnapping? Maybe that's the high profile one. I mean, they just seem like they have like zero leads like all the time.
Yeah. And Jean-Claude's condition after they rescue him for the umpteenth time, you know, that I think the first one, I was beginning to suspect maybe that was not all that it appeared to be. But then
yeah.
I think it was the second or third one. He was like really shooken up and like a lot more upset than he was after the first one. And so, yeah, all these questions, you know, at this point, I'm like, what's going on? This, you know, getting really caught up in the mystery of it and trying to figure it out. Yeah.
Yeah, because he was nice. He was like calm and collected after the very first attempt. One thing that that we didn't mention was that there's a chestnut vendor as well that keeps appearing in different spots. Every time Jean-Claude seems like he's about to be kidnapped, there's always this chestnut vendor there. That, yeah. And there's like three or four other guys that always try to get him too.
Yeah. I mean, when you're a rich prince of a small nation, I guess you're a hot commodity.
I guess so, yeah. Yeah. So Bess is in charge of like checking out the pictures, taking them to the police and various agencies and seeing if there's any kind of match anywhere. They kind of do the background checks on these, the pictures that Joe has left over. None of them check out. All the father, son, all the older gentlemen, younger gentlemen picks. Most of them are father, son. Some are there actually with families. So that kind of rules out them as being the actual cat burglars. And so they're kind of really stumped on this one. And by the time they figure out that Fiona and her dad, Dr. Fox, are actually the cat burglars, it's too late. They've disappeared. They've checked out. You know, they realize, well, you know, all this time we've been looking for father-son teams. Maybe it's a father-daughter team. Mm. They're gone. And that's like the end of this portion of the cat burglar phase of the of the story for now.
Yeah.
And the rest doesn't come back into play at all until like the last 10 pages or so.
Of course. Right. Got to wrap up all of our plot lines. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. Yeah. Oh, man. So Bess and Jean-Claude actually get kidnapped legit for real. Nancy and Frank are completely just, I mean, they can't save them. They're distraught. They're worried out of their minds. They're calling the police. They go to Renault, Count Renault, who's his uncle, Jean-Claude's uncle. He's part of the royalty. He was actually initially opposed to Jean-Claude's dad, the king, and his plan of, you know, joining the UN. But it seems like he's come around, and now he's just, you know, Jean-Claude's chaperone because, you know, he believes in royalty and you know, heads of state, you know, being superior and things like that. So they figured, what better chaperone, you know, for this aloof and reckless Jean-Claude than Count Renault. And so they go to Count Renault and they say, hey, Jean-Claude's like been kidnapped. And he's like very upset with them until Jean-Claude appears. And Jean-Claude is just like completely confused and dazed. He doesn't understand what's going on at all. So they, you know, they tell him, look, we got to go find Bess. I don't know where she is. I know it's in, or I know it was like in a shabby place. There was a lot of warehouses kind of looking places that were kind of run down. So it's maybe somewhere there. That's about all I know. But luckily, Nancy and Frank had found a clue. It was like some scrawling on a piece of paper, some numbers that they looked like math was being done, mm-hmm. that was dropped. And at first they're like, well, it could be nothing. It's like, well, it could be something too. And, you know, so they have that. They think, well, let's use this plus Renault's, plus Jean-Claude's memory, and maybe we can find this place. Mm. And this is where it like turns into like nonstop action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it was like pretty much the last half of the book was just constant go, 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 go. And
yes.
It wore me out. I'm not gonna lie. It's like, oh my goodness, can we take a minute and just have a, I don't know, nap or something? Yeah.
Oh man.
Well, that's why they called in Frank and Joe and not me.
Yeah, my daughter, she for the national, what is it, junior honor society or something, whatever she's part of, she had to go tutor some kids in like this math games. Or like they use these games, whatever. So we went over there the other night, and while she was doing all that, and I was just sitting there with the parents, I was just reading this, just enthralled, like, oh, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen next? Because it is nonstop action at this point. Mm. So Jean-Claude, who it really seems like he's actually kind of falling for Bess a little bit. Mm-hmm. He's like, no, we have to go save her. Like, I don't care if you think she's beneath me or beneath us, you know, royalty uncle, we got to go save her. So the uncle gets Francois, the limo driver, and he's like, okay, but I'm going to come with you. And he says this, Nancy notices after she overhears him saying something about Lexington Avenue, mm-hmm. which kind of comes into play. So, you know, she's like, okay, whatever. He insists on coming. That's fine. So they all go. Nancy has like this sudden moment of genius where she tells Frank, you know, hey, we need to stop and find like, you know, a book stand or something, newsstand, just wherever they sell like the, you know, some sort of a like city map or book. And so Frank, you know, being the really clever one, he kind of comes up with an excuse like, hey, you know, maybe we should stop for. We're worried about gas. How much gas do we have? You know, we can't just be driving around. And they're like, okay, fine, we'll stop. So they double back. Nancy goes in and buys one of these city map guide things. And she realized that the numbers that were scrawled on that paper weren't like basic math. It was like a formula that was used to figure out how to get to a certain street in New York, which I have no experience of New York like at all. So mm-hmm. I'm just going to take the book's word for it on this one, honestly.
Yeah. Well, and if it had to do with math, I mean, again, I would be hopeless. Possibly map reading too. I mean, I always imagine being Joe Hardy in these stories, but I think in actuality, I'd be Chet, you know, the bumbling guy who causes all the trouble in the background there. Yeah. But I was thinking, how different would this book be if they had cell phones, you know?
Just right, yeah,
the maps and calling people and I don't know, taking pictures even, you know.
Yeah. Well, and it's very much like that movie Commando with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember. Oh, yeah. It So, you know, he's supposed to be on a plane and he gets off the plane and he goes to, he follows like one of the bad guys. And as he's following the bad guy in the mall, the bad guy like clocks him. And so he goes to call like the boss to tell him like, hey, Matrix didn't get on the plane. But while he's there, he's like looking for a quarter. He's like, come on, give me a quarter. He's just trying to take a quarter so he can use a payphone to call the boss. It's like, that would not work at all today. You just open up your phone, you know, and you just make the call.
Yeah.
And you're right. It would be like the same thing. You just, you know, with your phone, just be taking pictures and you have them instantly. There's no need to develop, you know, Fiona or she would actually have to not ruin the negatives, but she'd have to like delete the pictures off his phone. I mean, there's like a whole it's like a whole thing now.
Yeah, I couldn't stop thinking about that for whatever reason. Like, just use your cell phone. Oh wait, yeah.
But they come to the realization, the Hardys and Nancy, that you know, Jean-Claude, like based off all the information they have, Jean-Claude actually kidnapped himself. Like he had himself kidnapped, at least initially. And so he can finally confess. He's like, yes, look, I hired the chestnut vendor to kidnap me for like $1,000 because quite frankly I didn't want to be around, but like I don't know what's going on with these others because I didn't hire them. Like I don't know who's trying to kidnap me and why. So all this is revealed while they're on their way. And they finally get to the Lexington Avenue, which is a little suspicious that, you know, the Count had mentioned it earlier, and now that's mm-hmm. where that warehouse is that they were tied up in.
Yep.
And so they split up. So Frank and Nancy go one way, Joe and Jean-Claude, who still kind of don't really like each other because Joe's a little jealous that Bess kind of prefers Jean-Claude.
Yeah. I mean, sorry, Joe, but he's rich. He's a prince.
Yeah, he's a prince, man. Come on.
Yeah, you got nothing. Sorry.
Yeah, don't feel bad. It's okay. He's a prince.
Yeah, that's right.
So they split up. Frank and Nancy get captured and are taken to the same room as Bess and tied up. Joe and Jean-Claude see them, and so they realize, okay, one of us is going to have to cause a diversion because they're gentlemen, you know, they're the gangsters or whatever with guns up there, the kidnappers. And so we need some way to get in, and so someone can sneak in and get them out. So Jean-Claude is like, look, I got us into this mess. I'll create the diversion because that's more dangerous. Even though Joe was going to volunteer because Joe, you know, he's like, well, I should. I'm braver. I'm stronger. I'm faster. I should. But Jean-Claude volunteers. He's like, I already know what I'm going to do. Just go get him. So turns out Joe sneaks up there. He starts untying them. And as they're about to be caught, Jean-Claude actually drives like a forklift into the building. He starts like just ramming the building and shaking the foundations. And so the crooks are just like, what's going on? He's, you know, it's like, are we under attack? And yeah. it's funny. They think it's like they go to the most ridiculous places.
Yeah. And yeah. It's threatening to become a 1980s action movie at this point now.
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much. That's all it is. So they managed to escape. They're going to jump back in the limo. The limo's completely gone. They have no idea what happened. So they manage to take the subway. And as they're there, they realize that the crooks weren't really after Jean-Claude. They were after Bess. And that's why Jean-Claude was able to escape. They're like, well, why would he be after Bess? You know, what does she have or what, you know, what purpose in their hunger? She's like, I'm so hungry. I have that crown. Just bring me the crown. I'm going to eat the crown, you know, that I was going to give for a gift. She takes a bite and like immediately washes her mouth out because there's like some yellow ooze inside. So it's not actually a fully chocolate crown. It's just a chocolate shell that has been filled with this ooze, which Frank recognizes as plastique, the explosive.
Yes. Is that really what that's called? Or, I mean,
yeah,
I guess so. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. But they've come a long way from, you know, using magnifying glasses. And
yeah.
It's like, oh, that's plastique.
Yeah, I always wondered if plastique was actually what they call, you know, in real life. It just seems too on the nose, you know. Plastic explosives from plastique. Is that how that worked? Okay.
Yeah, I guess so.
Don't ask me. I'm
at least
a bomb
in the
maker,
movies. So. That's what we know from the movies. So.
Okay, that's enough for reality for me then.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, yeah. I'll believe it. So they realize that it's a bomb, and these special orders were going to be, you know, there were more of them. It was a special order. We got to stop, you know. And they also realized that it's in the shape of the crown, you know, the crown jewel from Sarkon. And so they're like, these guys are not just, you know, kidnappers or whatever. They're like murderers and terrorists. So they're going to bomb this place. And so we got to do something. But while they're trying to figure all that out, Joe and Bess go to the bakery and they try to break in just so they can see, or not, well, they end up breaking in, but they actually try to go first to see if they can stop the delivery because they realize that, you know, these are explosives. So they end up having to break in and they're followed by some of those thugs from earlier. And so they end up having to fight off the thugs. Frank and Nancy meet them there and they end up, you know, again fighting each other off. Joe is like almost drowned in like a big old vat of chocolate. He's got like chocolate all over him and
love that part.
I do too. That's like just such a fun gag. It's yeah. And I could picture it, you know, like
yeah,
And I wondered, like, what would I do if I was drowning in chocolate?
Just start drinking. I mean,
that's right.
What a way to go.
Might as well.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But they were able to discover that, you know, they're headed for the UN embassy and or whatever it is that they're hosting wherever. Mm. And so they rush off, and then we get like a car chase, which is kind of fun here. Mm-hmm. So they get in the car first because they're with the limo, and Francois ends up, you know, they're like, quick, take us to the UN, you know, the UN signing thing. And so Francois is like, you know, I just do what I'm told. And they're like, well, that's an odd response. And essentially he was told by Renault to drive them far away. But mm-hmm. Nancy is quick thinking, and she ends up like putting some of the plastique on the, you know, the divider, that windshield that is there in the limo, and she attaches the detonator, and she's like, you know, hey, if we're gonna die because you're taking us somewhere to be killed or whatever, you're coming, you're going too. So he freaks out, he lets him go. Of course, she didn't actually use the plastique, she used some of this very expensive face cream that Bess had convinced her to buy.
Yep. I love that callback all the way to the opening chapter.
All the way to that opening shopping, yeah.
Yep. I loved it.
And yeah, so they're still chased by these guys. They end up going on foot. They finally make their way to the UN, and this is where like the big, you know, the big action sequence happens. They totally pull a Karate Kid and sneak in as in, through the kitchens as waiters. And as they're making their way, they realize that it's the DJ is the one that's he's probably most likely to have the detonators. And it's confirmed later on when the DJ is speaking with Renault, because at this point they figured out that Renault is not the guy that he says he is. He's actually the head of the resistance, like an underground resistance fighting against the king, because they believe in like landownership, nobility, and just all sorts of things that are, I don't know. I don't know a nice way to say this. They're just very uppity, and they don't want to join with anybody else.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
That's probably the nicest way to say it without being a jerk.
Isolationists, maybe?
Maybe, yeah.
Like, we don't want to join the UN. We just want to be our own nation kind of deal. Is that what I think?
Yeah, but also because not so much, you know, to stay out of people's conflicts, but mostly because they kind of feel like they're better than everyone because they're royalty. Okay. And
that's right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they managed to stop the DJ and, you know, they realize that there's no way to get all the detonators out of all these different chocolate crowns that are on the tables here, because security would totally get them. So they have to go for the detonator they have to go for the remote. Mm-hmm. Which they figure out is on the DJ. They manage to get there. The DJ, you know, of course, puts up a little fight, and this is where Renault like pulls out a gun, and he has like the detonator, and he's, you know, about to press it and blow everybody up. He confesses to Jean-Claude that, you know, hey, I'm still at odds with your dad. He's wrong. You know, we don't want to join the UN and, you know, be a part of their stupid group. And so he's about to press it, and there's all this back and forth. And it turns out, luckily, Joe had actually cut the wires. So, so it's okay.
Somehow.
Yeah.
Good job, Joe.
And they detain, they get him. The DJ tries to get away, but Nancy and Joe actually push back on the revolving door in the opposite direction, and so he can't actually escape, which is it's funny because I remember as a kid always like not wanting to, like, just dreading being caught in one of those revolving doors, like, ah, I don't want to get stuck.
Claustrophobic.
And so the book ends with everybody, you know, Jean-Claude's going to be a good king. He's going to learn how to rule his kingdom, and you know, mm-hmm. So he can't be with Bess. Frank and Nancy, it's still kind of that unresolved thing. But
someday they'll get married. I
like that. That's my headcanon too. Oh, I know what I forgot. As all that stuff was happening, they caught Fiona Fox and her dad, the cat burglars, the real cat burglars, stealing the crown jewels while all this other terrorist stuff is going on. And as they chase them, they drop the jewels. And so they recover everything. Even though they get away, they end up recovering everything. So they kind of solve that case just by happenstance.
Hey, it's a win. Yeah, we'll take it. We'll get.
I really liked
time.
It, but it's definitely a far cry from like going up, to the tower and like, checking everything and exploring to see if they can find any clue to a hidden treasure. I don't know. It did feel very much like just action movie, which it was still cool. I really enjoyed the book. I really liked it. I want to read it again, but it did kind of seem a little disparate from their initial runs.
Yeah, and that's the vibe, I think, with the Case Files compared to the
Case Files
older,
in general. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very action-packed. If I remember right, it almost seemed like every chapter ended on a cliffhanger, kind of.
And I think that was one of the mandates, actually.
Yeah, and then you're left like, oh, I got to keep reading, And then the older series seemed more like a kind of a slower paced, trying to follow the treasure map kind of thing, or uncover a mystery of what's going on in this old house or wherever. I remember different plot lines, but yeah, this one especially, it felt like the action was really cranked, but it could be because it was a super mystery, and now we've got Nancy That's along true. With us, and it's the Avengers here, so we got to bring our A game.
Well, and also I think in general the Case Files and the super mysteries were aimed at a little bit older audience, teens, and so whereas some of the originals were aimed at a little bit younger audience, especially after the revisions in 59, that's when they really brought it down. But this was a fun one. I enjoyed it, it brought back like all the memories, because I remember, and I guess I'm jumping ahead here because this is going to be my happiest moment, but I just remember, like, because I couldn't fall asleep, I would just lie in bed reading these books, with the lights kind of dim, and just trying to read as many chapters that I could until, I realized, okay, I've read 3 chapters, it's this time, I got to go to bed, and then I'd fall asleep. And I just remember I had that feeling as I was reading this. I felt like I was lying in bed reading the book, even though I was, standing up or in my car during my lunch break trying to get this done, And so I just, it was wonderful. I loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. Same. It just brought back so many good memories. And I think I was just grinning like a kid through most of the opening chapters and, getting to run with Frank and Joe again. That was just a blast. So,
yeah. So I do have a question for you. If you could cast 80s actors as the leads in this book, like Frank, Joe, and Nancy, who would you cast?
That's going to be tricky, because I'm not sure I'm super familiar with enough young actors or even actors from the 80s to do it justice. I feel like, I'm not sure. Yeah, that's... I guess at any age, I mean, I would look at the cast from the Breakfast Club maybe or something. Was it Molly Ringwald? Was that the actress in that movie? I could see her doing Nancy Drew, playing Nancy Drew. Yeah. I'm not sure about the other two. I would probably just cast myself as Joe Hardy. I mean,
that's a good choice.
Yeah.
I had a hard time with it as well. I was thinking about it. On the cover, I noticed Frank kind of looks like Tom Cruise a little bit. So I thought, well, maybe a young Tom Cruise could play him.
Yeah, yeah. I could see that.
Yeah.
I didn't even think about Tom Cruise being an 80s actor.
That's right, because we're used to him now.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I think he could pull it off. Maybe C. Thomas Howell. For Joe, I can see it.
Yeah, I do have to say the way they drew them on the cover, it I'm like, these guys look like they're 40 or something. You know, they're in their 30s. Yeah.
But the 80s was a time when like everybody dressed like they were in their, you know, like they were 40.
Maybe Johnny Depp could do Frank Hardy.
Oh, that'd be a good one. Yeah.
Because he didn't really do the weird acting choices back then, did he? I'm not familiar with his super early work. So, I love his movies, and I love the wackier the better, but maybe with because he did 21 Jump Street, maybe that would be an easy jump in for him.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I could see him actually doing a good job at that, you know, in that era. So mm-hmm. It was before he started doing all the really quirky stuff. So I definitely could see it. Yeah. That's a good choice. I thought Elizabeth Shue could be Nancy Drew. I thought she'd be a good Nancy Drew.
Adventures in Babysitting. What a great movie.
I know. It's so good.
Classic.
Like she kind of has, you know, she has the brains. She mm-hmm. seems like, you know, she definitely has the beauty. And I think she has the guts that she'd be a pretty good Nancy Drew.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway.
Yeah, I'd go with that.
So we were talking about all the memories and everything. I kind of, you know, we've already kind of done the hap, hap, happiest, whatever. But what would you say, if you could, would be officially your hap, hap, happiest memory of the Hardy Boys in general?
Yeah. You know, I specifically after I started reading them, I mean, I can just remember reading them on a warm summer day or night. You know, I grew up in Illinois. And so, you know, I can just remember having like our bedroom window open, hearing the cicada noises outside and, all the warm air just coming in. And I'm just on my bed reading the Hardy Boys. And you know, when I pick up a Hardy Boy book, I mean, that's where my mind goes and is back to that time when I was young and just spending time in my room reading these books. but I have a very clear image and memory of that kind of an experience. And I know it's not a very Christmassy one, but I loved it because I think these were my superheroes, you know, when I was a kid. And I wasn't into comic books that much, but these guys, you know, they could do anything and I was along for the ride and it was great. It just, you know, fueled my imagination, and reading it again just brought me back to that stage of just having no care in the world other than, you know, it's a late summer night and I'm just in bed reading and enjoying the experience and hearing the noises from outside, and it just nothing better. I think they call it nostalgia.
They do. Yes, they actually do.
Yeah. There's gotta be a word for it, but yeah, it just brought it back to me, and I'm just, it was a wonderful experience reading them. Yeah.
And like I said, mine is definitely just my dad giving me that first one and me just reading through it, you know, just lying in bed. I still remember my light blue walls and the shelf was right in front of me. And, you know, I was across the room and had my toys and everything stacked all nice. And there was a row of books, and that row started growing with a bunch of Hardy Boy books. Just, it was, I mean, they were so cool. They were our age, well, older, but you know, they were our age and they went on all these adventures and they rode their motorcycles and, you know, it was neat. They noticed things that I might not have noticed. And so I was so fascinated by everything in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Now we come to my favorite part of the show, which is a little segment I like to call Gag Me with a Spoon. So this is where we do our best impression of our least favorite parts. Now, it's a book, so we're very lucky because we can kind of say it however we want. but as a guest, I'll let you go first, just kind of set up the scene a little bit.
Okay. I don't know how much of a section I'm going to be allowed to read here, but I want to go to...
However long you want.
Okay, well, I'll start with chapter 1, page 1. No, but... this is chapter 18 when they're fighting against the bad guys, and this is the scene where Joe gets dumped into the hot chocolate, I love when he's wrestling with the bad guy, you know, and he says, I'll just read from his quote there to the end of the chapter. It's just a little paragraph, but it says, "Let's sweeten his disposition a little," the first one grunted, and let loose with a punch to Joe's abdomen. Bess screamed at exactly the same pitch as the wailing siren. For a moment, everything went black. Joe's body slumped, and when his eyes opened, he was flying through the air toward a deep, hot, churning mass of molten chocolate. Dun, dun, dun. I love the corny pun, you know, let's sweeten his disposition, and you know, they chuck him over. Goodness. And I don't know, it's just super dramatic, and he's falling towards his molten chocolate.
Because yeah. Who talks like that?
I know, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's good. That's good. Mine was, so this is where Nancy has, after they've escaped, and she's done the whole fake out with the plastique, you know, and it turns out it was just that cream. And so this is Joe, and he says, "Face mud." Joe groaned, rolling his eyes. "I thought you'd lost your mind." Just face mud? I don't ever remember hearing face mud before. So I was like, what? What are you talking about? Anyway.
I guess if a guy trying to describe women's cosmetics, I mean, I'd go with face mud.
Yeah, you're right. Especially in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh man. But yeah, it does make me wonder. So G.I. Joe taught us that knowing is half the battle. What do you think the other half is?
Boy, I'm unprepared for this too. the other half is knowing that your brother has got your back.
Oh, I love that. That's awesome. That's really good. That's way better than mine. Mine is, so if knowing's half the battle, the other half is just tasting all sculpted chocolate pieces to make sure that they're not full of plastique.
So there you go.
Sample them all.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. You never know. I thought I'd go with a more serious one this time. So
it's good. Yeah, it's true. Definitely true. Yep. At least yep. It is for us. Art, it's been absolutely fun talking about the Hardys and this crazy action packed story. But you know, what do you want to plug? Like, you know, what do you got coming up, or tell me about your shows?
Sure. I'm doing the Cozy Christmas podcast, and we're doing a monthly reading challenge. And so I've been able to have different prompts every month for us to be reading a book or more based on the prompt. And I'm trying to find authors to come in and talk to that kind of match the prompt. Haven't had a lot of success with that. I mean, I've been able to get some on, just they haven't really matched what we're reading sometimes. So, well, that's all right. I'm really finding some great new writers that have just been writing some wonderful series. And that's been so fun, and really making a connection with them too, that, been able to just, you know, keep the conversation going after the episode has been out, and just emailing and making friends with writers. So that's always a plus. But yeah, we're doing that. I think I've got some plans for some Christmas in July things coming up. We'll see what works out. And then I've been doing another podcast that just covers books in general, called The Bookshelf Odyssey. And that's, I described it one time as it's like my Christmas podcast without the Christmas part. So I just find it so many good stories to read or talk about that weren't Christmas related, and I'm crazy. So I thought I'd go ahead and start another one just to kind of, you know, in case I wasn't busy enough. So that's been fun. Gotten to meet some great writers through that. And turns out they're always really happy to have anyone want to talk to them about their books and help them promote it and all that. So, yeah, it's been a blast. Just really focusing on reading this year, especially. And I've had some great feedback on that too. So, you can check us out at CozyChristmasPodcast.com is the main website. You can find the podcast is posted there, or it's on the Libsyn website as well. But anyway, wherever you download podcasts, that's there. And same with Bookshelf Odyssey. I'm on the internet.
Right on. Good stuff. Yeah, definitely check out A Cozy Christmas. It's like all the warm, fuzzies of Christmas wrapped up in a podcast. It's amazing. So
Yeah, I try. And my daughter, she just tomorrow's her last day of school for the summer, so we have plans to get Grace back on and have some fun with her this summer. So she's been real busy this last couple of months. She's been wanting to get on, but I said, well, you're gone so much, you know, because of all the school activities she's doing. So
right.
Yep. So the more popular host of the show, she'll be on again. So
right on, yep. Man. I dig it.
Yep.
Thanks again. It was fun.
Definitely. So thanks. And if you ever want to do anything Hardy Boys again, give me a shout out.
I will for sure.
I'll come running. Yep.
And on that note, I'll end it by saying, I'll never forget the look on Reynaud's face when they carted him off. He'll have a great Christmas in jail, I'm sure. And he'll check us out on our social media pages, Facebook and Instagram at Totally Rad Christmas and Twitter at Rad Christmas, or our Facebook group, Totally Rad Christmas Mall and Arcade, where you can make your voice known to us as well. We post anything and everything 80s or Christmas related. And if you're feeling like Nancy and the Hardys solving the mystery and stopping the villains, leave us a review on iTunes. It helps us reach more people and spread some rad holiday cheer. Now, don't forget to check out our merch shop on tpublic.com with some brand new designs and our super dope website, totallyradchristmas.com, courtesy of Tis the Podcast Elf, Tom Crow. Have a wonderful Christmas. I hope we get the chance to do this again. Later, dudes.